You're listening to an American Theater podcast. American Theater is published by Theater Communications Group. www.americantheater.org.
Welcome to Off Script, American Theater's podcast on all things theatrical. I'm Editor-in-Chief Rob Weinert-Kent. I'm here with...
Deep Tran, Associate Editor.
And I'm Senior Editor Susie Evans.
And today, on today's show, we're going to talk about the moment that Ivo van Hove is having, the Belgian director who's had three productions so far this fall, and we'll have another one in the winter here in New York. And we'll also be talking about The Wiz Live, which was on last night.
Exclamation point.
Is there an exclamation point part of the title? Okay,
point.
Great. It's important to verbally note that. There needs to be a verbal sound for that. Didn't Victor Borg give a... like you would do that for the... Anyway.
That sounds like Kid Pick Studio.
And then we have an interview today with Cheryl L. West, playwright who has written many plays, but we're talking to her specifically about her adaptation of Aquila and the Bee, which is at Children's Theater Company in Minneapolis?
It was at Children's Theater Company.
Oh, it's
Company,
at Arena Stage.
And now it's at Arena Stage.
Right, in Washington, D.C. So it's a great show. Hope you stay tuned for the whole thing, and then we'll do some recommendations at the end. So starting off, we're going to talk about Ivo van Hove, Belgian director, artistic director of the Toneel Group. I don't know if I'm saying that right. It sounds like Toneel Group, but Toneel Group, which is a group in Amsterdam. In Amsterdam?
Yeah, Amsterdam.
Yeah. Anyway, so, but he's based in Belgium, or he's from Belgium.
It's Belgian. He's Belgian.
Or he's Belgian. All right.
Belch, I almost said.
We have to start right out and say that we feel a little underqualified to talk about him. Although this magazine has covered him intently over the years, we did a cover story on him in 2009, because he's been coming over to the States for almost 10 years, I think. The first splash, I remember reading the review, was of a production of Streetcar with Elizabeth Marvel, in which the main, if not only, set piece was a bathtub. And it was supposed to be an amazing, revelatory production. And since then, he's been known here mainly for his stark, minimalist approach to classics, Molière. He tends to just set them matter-of-factly in present-day settings without much comment on it, not making any point, really, just... And it tends to set them in bare, beautifully designed spaces. I forget his partner is his main designer. Is it Jan?
Jan Westerf. I'm so sorry to these people whose name we can't pronounce. Jan Westerfold or something.
He's yes.
He's a scenic designer, and he also is this production photographer.
Right.
And does the...
And so he's having a huge moment now. We have a story online about it. A couple months ago, he brought his Antigone with Juliette Binoche to BAM. I didn't see that. Did you?
I didn't either. I didn't hear great things about it, though.
Oh, okay.
I heard it was disappointing.
I heard good things about it, but he's very divisive in some ways. Yes.
Oh, and also played Kennedy Center, too.
Yeah, and then I think it was earlier this year or last year. I really wish I'd seen this. It was in Dutch or Belgian or Flemish. His production of Angels in America was supposed to be...
Oh, yeah, I didn't see it.
Oh, yeah,
amazing.
I wish I saw that.
With a bunch of music by David Bowie. We'll come back to that in a second, to the convergence of those artists. But in any case... his production of View from the Bridge, which is an English production from the National Theater, I believe, is now on Broadway.
Wait, is it the National Theater? No, it's the Young Vic, I think.
Also opening soon, I think maybe this weekend, is Lazarus, which is in many ways a big departure for him because it's a brand new sort of musical written with David Bowie and Enda Walsh. Based on partly on the novel "The Man Who Fell to Earth" by an author whose name I don't recall. In any case, it's billed as sort of a sequel to "The Man Who Fell to Earth," which is a really trippy Nicholas Roeg movie I saw when I was a huge Bowie fan as a teenager, and still don't understand what that movie was about.
Wasn't David Bowie in the original movie?
Yeah, no, he was the man who fell to earth.
Yeah,
and you know what's interesting about that? We could talk about that. I'm going to see that tonight. Is how much David Bowie's entire career has been about aliens and people from outer space and how much he's embodied that and made that part. I mean, he sort of took on the look from that movie as his look as a performer for
like
a while.
Stardust. Right?
No, it was after that. It was
really?
The low era. That was when he was going slightly less glam and more Euro. He had burnt orange hair then. And wore large overcoats, and I that was a particularly favorite era for me. So the only show that any of us in this room have seen by Eva Van Hove is View from the Bridge.
Which is from The Young Vic.
The Young Vic, sorry about
but
that.
But National yeah. Theater Live has done a live streaming of it.
And that's so where I got confused.
Yeah, so because they kind of are an umbrella of those UK theaters. But yeah, so we've seen View from the Bridge, which was my first introduction to that Arthur Miller play, which, let me tell you, a stark Eva Van Hove staging of an American classic. It's kind of a weird introduction to a play.
Yeah, certainly, certainly.
But I thought one of the things that was interesting about it, and this was in our piece online, was how there's two props used in the whole production. There's a chair and there's a cigar. And if you count the pair of high heels, which are important in the plot, there's three. And the thing is, Ivo let his actors decide when the props were needed. And so they went in with no props. Like, they're like, we're not going to do this with any props. We're not going to do this with anything. And then he basically was like, that's like, well, I should really have a cigar. I shouldn't mind smoking a cigar. Or like the chair, there's a really important moment with the chair. And then the high heels are like an important, oh, because it's all modern costumes or not yeah. in any case. So they put on high heels. And so I thought that was, it was like an actor-led prop decisions.
Hmm. I will say what's interesting, it was not a complete slam dunk for me. In part because there was such a great production a couple years ago, Greg Mosher directed, with Liev Schreiber in the lead and Corey Stoll and Scarlett Johansson, that really did it straight, you know, did it set in Red Hook with a fairly realistic set, a little bit of expressionism in the outdoor setting of that. And, you know, that was my first experience with the play, that one, and Michael Christopher played the lawyer. And I was intrigued by the Ivo Van Hove production. It did feel very much an actor. It felt like an actor-led production. It felt a bit distancing and disorienting to see. I think Mark Strong is amazing as Eddie Carbone.
Oh, his performance was insane.
And so is it Nicola Walker playing his wife?
Yeah, Nicola plays his wife.
But I mean this not in a mean way to say it felt a little bit like intelligent aliens playing the parts. They felt a little bit like they were dropped in out of nowhere and conjuring a play rather than really staging it, you know? I mean, that's kind of the idea because it's such a bare setting.
Well, that's why I think it's interesting that I had never seen the play before. So yeah. I liked it. I think one of the things it does so well, it's just a bare stage. There are audience seats on the stage on either side, so it kind of becomes audience on three sides of the stage. And there's really interesting sound design and lighting design and sort of effects with this very, very minimalist set. It's kind of hard to explain. But having never seen the play or even read it, I hate to admit, I feel like it really brought the language to light because you're focusing on the words so much. There's
right.
nothing else to distract you. And so you really understand the play.
That's true.
In a really different way than if you were like watching it happen. Like there's not like the table where they're having dinner and they're not in the shipyards. And
yeah.
So I thought it really brought the text to light in a really interesting way.
That's very true. I would say that's one of the weaknesses too, is I think that Arthur Miller and his use of language, that's not his strongest suit, let's just say. He's not Tennessee Williams. He's not Tony Kushner. And I would just say it's a bit of a – it's not as tight a play as I would like. It gets repetitious to the point of like, okay, get on with it. We get the main themes. We get what's going on. And I think in a more naturalistic production, that didn't bother me as much. Here, the text was so exposed that I felt like I wouldn't mind if he cut it a little bit. But it's this weird – and I respect this. I think Ivo is a really interesting director because – he does a sort of European Reggie Theater thing where it's not deconstructing, but just like stripping it back. He's doing a very heavy directorial concept in a way, but he honors the text. He honors every word of it and finds a reason for it. And I think sometimes that exposes these slightly loose, baggy American plays as being kind of loose and baggy to me. And that's how I felt.
Well, it's interesting that a Belgian director has come over with a mostly British cast. I think a few characters were recast for the Broadway transfer mm-hmm. with American actors to do a play set in Red Hook, Brooklyn
yeah.
for American audiences.
I know. I have wondered. Someone told me that the accents in London were more generic. Mm-hmm. That's hard to believe. It sounds like at least they've stepped up for New York audiences that say in there from – you know, Brooklyn.
From Brooklyn. Well, it's funny. I actually had the – I went to the opening night of the show and got to speak with the cast a little bit. And they said that there's so many lines that get laughs in New York that didn't get laughs in London.
Oh, sure.
Like about like the Staten Island line there's like, yeah, and like yeah. Red Hook. Because like British audiences didn't get that. And they're like, oh, this is a funny line. Like they didn't even know.
Well, this is one cast I would love to hear them in their original voices where they it would be really disoriented to hear Mark Strong speak in his...
He's British, Mark
yes,
Strong.
Yes, I know.
But I think Michael Zegan is Marco in this production.
Yeah, no, he's American.
And he didn't do it in England. So he's great.
I recognize the Rodolfo guy from Hearst Boys. What's his name?
I don't know what his name is.
Anyway.
It's a great production. And you forgot to mention that the other production Evo's doing this year is The Crucible in the
right.
spring.
Well, in the spring, yeah. Another Arthur Miller. I have no idea.
Where is it playing?
On Broadway.
It's on Broadway. And it's created for Broadway, right?
I think it's created. I think I'm right here in that Sarah's Ronan is playing the girl. I
do know that Ben Whishaw and Karen Hines are in it. And Siobhan. Is there someone named Siobhan in it?
Anyway. I'm Googling it right now.
Sophie Okonedo. Is that pronounced that correct?
Oh, yeah. You're pronouncing that correctly. Okay. She's in it.
There was an ad for that in the program, of course. So if you like Arthur Miller and Ivo van Hove, come back for his next installment.
Well, yeah.
I mean, that's such a different play. I think it's also a little loose and baggy and literal-minded. But it'd be interesting to see that play cleared of its heavy American associations that we have with it and see if it's something more clear and
yeah. The only reason I bring
universal.
Up the girl who's playing the young girl in it, Sarah Roy, I'm saying her name wrong, is because she's in that movie Brooklyn right now and she's a potential Oscar contender.
Oh,
so God. She's gotten very buzzy this fall, and now she's coming to Broadway in the spring with Evo. Ta-da!
Evo is everywhere. All right, so we were going to talk about The Wiz. Now, Deep is the only one in the room who has seen it, but Susie wrote a big story and did a lot of reporting about what seems to be like not just a trend, but something that's here to stay, these live television musical broadcasts. And now that new people are getting in on the act, The Wiz Live was by...
NBC.
Right, which is who's done it before.
Yeah, it was Craig Zanon and Neil Maron who've done the past three. Sound of Music with Carrie Underwood was the first one, then Peter Pan with Allison Williams and Christopher Walken, and now The Wiz.
Now The Wiz. But you wrote about how Grease Live is going to be in January, and that's...
That's Fox.
Fox.
Paramount
right.
Television is producing it, I believe, and they did the original Grease movie. And so it's an interesting marriage of movie, screen... movie, TV, and stage show.
Right. So even though the reviews and response have been mixed to these over the time they've done them, there's definitely a sense that this is a thing that's going to keep happening. So Deep, tell us about The Wiz. We didn't see it. We heard it was pretty interesting.
We heard it was good.
Yeah, it was surprisingly good. Unlike previous years where everyone on Twitter was hate watching the shows, we were actually watching it out of enjoyment. And the only big criticism people had was Toto didn't come to Oz with Dorothy. The dog stayed at home the entire time. Probably because they couldn't get the animal wrangler to.
Oh, was that a part of the live broadcast problem? Like the dog just wouldn't play?
I have no idea. Maybe that's my theory.
Okay.
Don't quote me on that
All
one.
All right.
But to some bare bones about the production, it was directed by Kenny Leon with a newcomer, 18-year-old Shanice Williams from New Jersey. It was the first audition she ever did.
For Dorothy.
Right. And the supporting players were the celebrities this time, in reverse of Sound of Music and Peter Pan, where the celebrity had to carry the entire show. Mm-hmm. So it was Mary J. Blige as Eveline. It was Uzu Adoba as Glenda, though she has Broadway credit, of course.
Sure.
Yes. And Amber Riley as the Good Witch of the North, whose name I do not remember.
Anna Pearl.
Thank you. And Queen Latifah as a butch androgynous Wiz.
Nice.
And also Common as a bouncer.
Okay.
And Neo and Elijah Kelly.
And Neo and Elijah. That's so many names. And they're all really talented performers. Because a really interesting thing I noticed was they didn't have many Broadway veterans this time. Mm-hmm. And the performance style was noticeably different insofar as these were mainly pop singers, but they could perform for the camera and also perform as a character, which was really interesting because then you have that magnetism of wanting to see this person perform. And they also, seeing this person perform live and do it very well and them knowing how to look at the camera.
Right. Well, how to work with the camera, right?
Yeah.
Was there a lot of dance in it?
Yes. I don't have the name of the choreographer. Of Susie
Fatima Robinson, I think, is the choreographer. And they also worked with Cirque du Soleil a little bit, I think.
Oh, yes. Wow. Okay.
During the sequence when Dorothy is transported to Kansas, it's Cirque du Soleil dancers on wires circling her as a tornado. So that was a pretty cool effect.
Wow.
Yeah.
And Paul Tazewell did the costumes. He did the costumes for Hamilton as well. And that was the big design highlight for me because it was very modern and it's a lot of glitter. Like Queen Latifah looked like she stole that out of Liberace's closet.
Right.
Because
right.
It's really overdone. Yeah. And Glinda's dress was this wired golden gown made of like fiber optic wires.
Wow.
And so she literally glowed as she walked around.
Nice.
That's amazing. Another design thing that's cool and another transition about The Wiz is Derek McClain did the sets. And the sets were designed this time in a proscenium setup. And so the scene transitions were like backdrops coming in because The Wiz is slated for the 2016-17 Broadway season. And so when I was talking with the producers about it, they said that, you know, if this broadcast goes well, which it seems like it did, and people liked it, it'll be the first time a TV show has been a commercial for a Broadway production. But the thing is that every design element had to be created as if it could be transferred to Broadway.
Yes.
Right.
And so the backdrops, instead of having like a 360 environment like you have in Peter Pan, or instead of having like a sort of proscenium, sort of 360 like environment with Sound of Music, you had like really just like it was a theatrical style. They weren't like hiding the fact that this was theater on TV.
Exactly. And then it didn't have, so that means like it looked stagey, but in a good way, because it didn't have that cheap look you had with The Sound of Music, where it kind of looked like they were filming a daytime soap opera.
Mm-hmm.
And the most.
Looked the same for Peter Pan, too.
Yeah. And the most amazing thing was there are some sequences where they showed the scene transitions, because most of the time they do the scene transitions during the commercial breaks. But with the fun of live theater is seeing all these very disparate scenes turn into each other.
Right. Well, that can be fun, but yeah, if it's done well.
If it's done well, seemed like it went smoothly from the scene transitions that I saw. And so for future years, that might be something fun to let the audiences at home see, because
So it sounds like it was more theatrical, and that was a strength rather than trying to downplay the theatricality of it. Like, show this is a piece of theater on TV. Why, acknowledge it, right?
Exactly. Because when you almost apologize for theatricalism, then it makes it look like you're filming something amateur.
Yeah, right, right. I also heard it's not just a commercial for Broadway. It's, in a way, an audition. Like, do you think these people are all going to – whether they would be able to do a run. I don't know if Mary J. Blige is going to take time from her touring schedule to be on Broadway. But do you feel like these folks are – Shanice is going to probably be on Broadway.
Yeah. When I talked to the producers about that, they said definitely, like, not everyone will obviously go to Broadway and think Queen Latifah. Although maybe Queen Latifah wants to do Broadway. I don't know.
Uzo.
But Uzo could do it. Or, like – but they definitely want to – I mean, they said in the interview that ideally they get to keep Shanice as Dorothy.
And she was great. That girl could sing, and she made people cry on Twitter when she sang Home.
Now, such a good song.
The one thing I saw on Twitter was some criticism of the book scenes, the dialogue scenes, and the way that those played. And I even saw I think you said this, but also Paula Vogel had a tweet today, said, why not film this in front of a live audience? It feels weird to not have a response for applause or for laughter or for just the audience response would be helpful.
Yeah, because Harvey Fierstein he revamped the book a little bit. And so he added in a little bit more backstory and motivation for Dorothy and did a little bit of cutting, just tightened it up. But the weird thing about, and I didn't notice it before, but the weird thing about watching dialogue scenes on TV is you usually have a little bit of underscoring to just kind of move things along.
Right.
But there is nothing like that. And so it was just them talking to dead silence.
Yeah,
and there's
no
audience laughter to kind of buoy up the lines or make you know that this line is pretty funny. It was, they were performing these lines like they were in a theater, but they were not in a theater.
Yeah.
And so it was just this really weird Twilight Zone effect of you're just performing in this giant empty room with no one else around.
I mean, I talked to Harvey about that. And one of the things he said was The Wiz is especially difficult because it's written to punchlines. The jokes are written to punchlines.
Yeah.
And jokes are written differently for a live audience than they are written for a TV audience. And so there's only so much changing you can do. I did think it was interesting that they didn't do it in front of a live audience this time, especially since they had the proscenium set up.
Yeah.
Like, why not bring a live audience in? And
it seems like if you're going to acknowledge the theatricality, then go all the way and make it theatrical.
Exactly.
Right?
And there's so many moments, like the big numbers or acrobatics where you want to clap, where they right. have this, you know, you hit the big note, it ends, and then there's just silence. Like, there's no one clapping, and you're just clapping alone in the apartment by yourself, and it's really awkward for everybody.
Right. What's interesting, though, is once you start to do that, then the feeling is, especially for a play that's going to go to Broadway, it's like, why not just open it on Broadway and broadcast it from Broadway? Like, it starts to become,
yes.
which cart goes before which horse here? Where they do, should we... Do we want to make a musical for people around the country to see? Or do you want to make one for Broadway? Or can we do both? I don't know.
Or can maybe we use this technology that they used to do The Wiz, which apparently did well, and it was a proscenium mm-hmm. setup, to film Broadway shows.
Right.
Because Broadway shows get filmed for Lincoln Center all the
exactly.
time, and there's a few, like National Theater Live, which I did a separate article about, that do it. But if they're capturing this in a proscenium, and I think if having an audience would be helpful... I mean, there's going to be cameras on stage, which would probably distract the audience
a little bit.
Well,
you do a special performance.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting because as soon as you think about, like, you add an audience to the mix, then it's not a live one-time event. It is, but, like, any theater pro would go, they need previews. Like, if you're going to have an audience, then you play with the audience and you calibrate. But if you just have an audience see the show for the first time, that would be scary for any theater artist.
Well, that's technically what they did.
That is.
Just
yeah.
showed
it
to
the whole country. Yeah. I know.
And
it's weird.
And the reactions weren't live in the room, but they were live on Twitter. So if
I
you
guess what I feel
backstage.
Like, I guess it's a question of there's so much in a live broadcast that they need to manage and that could go wrong and they need to plan for. If they have to also think about, oh my God, there's going to be how many hundreds, thousand people there who could be laughing, coughing, screaming, whatever, messing up the timing of. So I think maybe they'll add that at some point, but it's a whole other animals to add to the
yeah, but like
the mix.
Sitcoms have them, like
yeah. Well, sitcoms
well, that's
also
a very
edited,
strictly managed.
Well, yeah, and it's not live.
Well, no, but sitcoms. I mean, it's live.
It's
right?
live, but it's not
live.
Broadcast.
Yes,
well,
they
Saturday
edit,
Night
yeah.
Live is live. I mean, not for like half the sketch stuff, but for the monologues and for the performances, it's practically
no, it's
live.
So no, Saturday Night is
yeah.
live. With
unless
the delay,
lip syncing. Yeah,
but yeah,
you can lip sync live.
Yes, Britney Spears proved that for many years.
Well, also, you know, for these live broadcasts, they record everything ahead of time in case anything goes out. So
it's almost like they have to relearn things that people have been doing for decades or something, or centuries.
Or people are doing right now.
They're still doing, yeah.
Exactly. Well, because PBS used to do those broadcasts of musicals, and they incorporate the live audience into it, like Sunday in the Park of George, that's how I first got exposed to that musical.
Well, that was, I mean, that might have been great performances or performances
yeah,
in Lincoln Center.
So.
No, I, me too. I mean, that's how I saw Sweeney Todd, that production, which was taped actually at the Dorothy Chandler in L.A. Those are ways that people are exposed to musicals.
I mean,
I wish the Lincoln Center Library was just available. Come on, people.
Yeah. Well, you know. How well are those filmed, the Lincoln Center Library?
It varies.
You've seen them.
Yeah, I did a lot of watching of old musicals when I researched my Broadway's Yellow Fever article. It varies. I mean, the 1980s musicals, like, they get kind of grainy because they were shot on VHS.
Right.
Yeah. But for the most part, the quality is pretty amazing,
yeah.
and you do get that feeling of liveness and energy, and you can also really focus on the lines and enjoying that as well. And there wasn't that awkwardness that you see in The Wiz or Sound of Music, where you want that presence there.
It widely varies also because
yeah.
they have Broadway stuff, but I saw a bunch of Wooster Group stuff they have there at Lincoln Center, and that's really wildly varies in quality.
Yeah. Though the one criticism I would have of the video collection is they make you watch these really spectacularly staged shows on a tiny 1990s, you know, Sony TV. Like,
oh, do they?
Yeah, like a full
that.
Screen TV. It's not even a widescreen TV. It's a tiny little computer-sized
okay.
television.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it just makes everything look a little bit more crappy.
All right.
Well, that's a library for
nostalgia.
You.
Yeah.
Fun to the libraries, everyone. They need new TVs.
Yeah. There was something that struck me when I was reading the reviews this morning for The Wiz, which was a lot of people pointed out that people linked it back to what Viola Davis said when she won the Emmy, which is the only thing separating a performer of color from a white performer is opportunity. And so it was fantastic to see people actually tuning in to watch this all black version of what they thought was The Wizard of Oz. And it turned out to be something completely different, talking about black identity and empowerment and upending stereotypes about the community. And so it's just something to think about in future years when programming these kind of shows, that you don't need to necessarily cast them, you know, within a certain color line, because people will watch it anyway, even if they just hate watching it.
I mean, The Wiz is a classic, though. I mean, everyone loves The Wiz. It's been around for a while.
It's been around
40 years,
like,
basically.
Yeah, forever.
You know, and I think my wife was either part of or watched an Orange County production that was mostly Asian American, because that was.
Oh, I was in The Wiz, you guys. Don't I look like I should be in The Wiz?
Yes, of course. You look.
What role did you play?
I was an Emerald City citizen, so.
So you should have been green.
I was green. I did. I had to paint my face green.
Green face is okay, people.
Oh gosh.
Oh god. Oh my god.
Oh man, green face.
Well, that's what they do for Wicked. So.
It's true. Exactly. It was kind of like Wicked.
I guess if it's The Wiz, you don't want to cast across color lines, but just taking these material that isn't just for white audiences,
right.
Like something like King and I'll enjoy King and I as a whole, but if you wanted to put Asian performers on stage, that is how you would do it in a vehicle that many people recognize.
What surprised me most kind of on this is like how many people, I mean, there were all those silly articles on like BuzzFeed about people tweeting about The Wiz who like didn't know about The Wiz. They're like, mm-hmm. What is this?
Right. Well, you know, it hasn't been done in a while.
Yeah.
But
the movie bombed, didn't it?
I don't think it was seen as a success. I never saw it, but it had Michael Jackson in it.
And Diana Ross is a 32-year-old Dorothy. That's what I know about it.
Anyway.
It's overdue for a return. I'm glad to hear it was.
Yeah.
Great.
I mean, they did it at City Center about 6 years ago.
Oh, it was Encores?
Encores, I saw it because I loved the show.
Yeah.
And so it was not a great production at Encores, but they did do it at Encores, I think, 6 or 7 years ago.
But
it's come back to Broadway in 2016-17, and apparently it's great. So
I look forward to it. This also sounds like television broadcasts of musicals don't all suck, and maybe there's something that we could look forward to.
Yeah.
I think they're improving it every year. And also, if you didn't catch it last night, you can catch it on Hulu.
The free Hulu or the Hulu paid?
Well, the free Hulu has clips. So if there's one clip you should watch, by the way, it's the Emerald City clip because they're all dressed as like Studio 54 denizens with like big headpieces and shiny green suits, and they're all voguing. It is fantastic.
This will blow my kids' minds. They love Wizard of Oz.
Okay.
So I'll show
them. I'm going to go watch some clips when we get back to my desk.
So why don't we segue to our interview with Cheryl L. West. Deep, you spoke to her?
Yes. Her adaptation of Akeela and the Bee, that 2006 film starring Lawrence Fishburne, Kiki Palmer, Angela Bassett, is currently playing at Arena Stage through December 27th. And her other works include Draw the Floor and Before It Hits Home, which was a Susan Smith Blackburn Prize winner. And we also ran a profile of her when her show Pullman Porter Blues was in Seattle at Seattle Repertory Theater, and then it went to the Goodman and to Arena. Or maybe it went to Arena first. I don't remember.
All right.
But if you want to know more about her, you can read that article in our September 2013 issue. And
Or listen to this interview.
Listen to this interview.
All right. We'll be back in a sec.
Hello again, and I'm sitting down with Cheryl L. West. How often does the L come up in your professional title?
I would like it to be used all the time because there's another Cheryl West out there. Well, there's a couple, but one is a writer, I hear.
Yeah.
And then there's another Cheryl L. West who also has been brought up on criminal charges. When I went to get my federal gun number, they were like, excuse me, where have you lived? And it turns out I had lived in Virginia at one point, and so had this Cheryl who sort of frauded the government. So that was really peculiar. So I always use the L.
Oh, wow. So we're talking with the Cheryl L. West that's not wanted on criminal charges.
Exactly. So, yeah, that was pretty curious for me as well.
Yeah. And what I've been curious about is you're based in Seattle, but you've been produced at Children's Theater Company and Arena Stage, which are also very far away from each other. One's in D.C., the other one's in Minneapolis. And so
I've been produced all over the country, and I think that I've worked at Minneapolis Children's Theater. This would be my second production with them, mm-hmm. and they originated the idea of adapting it for stage. one of their students who does work with them on stage said, hey, you should think about Akilah and the Bee to adapt that. And they were, you know, immediately asked me if I would be interested in doing that. And so I came on board. Mm-hmm. Then Charles Randolph Wright, who is a director, also works at Arena a lot. And so once he read it, he talked to Molly, who runs Arena Stage, and just said, you really should read this and see if you're interested. And she was immediately. And so, and I've been produced at Arena Stage. I think they said I'm the most contemporary playwright produced there.
Right. Well, so still alive. Yes.
Yeah. Still alive. I go way back. Probably about 26, 27 years.
Yeah. Well, they don't have a resident playwriting program. And so how did you, well, they do have like short-term residencies, of course, like with Katori Hall, but how did you get this long-term relationship with that very large theater?
Years ago, I think in 1987, I won a playwrights award to come out here to Seattle. That was the first time I'd been at Seattle at the group theater. Mm-hmm. And one of the artistic associates at the time, Toswell Thompson.
Oh, came, yes. I love him. Yeah.
Yes. He came out from Arena to see this workshop of my sort of first play. And he took it back to Arena. And a year and a, about 2 years later, they did the play, which was Before It Hits Home. And so that's kind of how I got to the Arena. And at that point, Zelda Fitchandler ran the Arena Stage. So I've been produced under each artistic director there. So it's been a long partnership, and I've always felt like the Arena Stage has supported me very well.
Yeah. Do you have a favorite artistic director? Or are you allowed to say?
No, I actually appreciated all. It's only been one, two.
Three,
yeah. And they all have been wonderful to me. I think that most playwrights are very grateful when they get their work produced. I mean, you know, that doesn't always happen. And when a theater makes a commitment to you where you feel like you're at least going to go to the top of the pile mm-hmm. when you have a new work, I think that's quite exceptional.
Right. And with a house like Arena Stage, it's like one of the biggest regional theaters that we have. And so if you get work produced there, then you're pretty set on it getting produced in like smaller houses around the country. So that must be really nice for you.
Yeah, it's been. I mean, I've had a long career. I'm also doing a new commission with the Arena Stage at the same time. So so I feel like that support is ongoing.
Yeah. Wait, so tell me a little bit about, well, Akilah and the Bee is based on the 2006 film, and it's about an 11-year-old girl from an inner-city Los Angeles middle school who competes in a nationwide spelling bee competition.
Yes. And the play is sort of follows that same storyline. However, it's been reset in Chicago because when I saw the movie, I took my children to see it. What I was the most struck by was the sort of rallying of the community. Mm-hmm. And it never left me, that idea that every person in the community or in her neighborhood could have something to do with encouraging this sort of spelling prodigy on.
Yeah.
So when you think about, you can't put a movie on stage, but when you think about how do you make that theatrical? So what I thought is, let me reset it in Chicago, because first of all, I'm from Chicago originally. Mm-hmm. Two, there's something about the sort of congestion of, and the verticalness of Chicago where people are literally living on top of each other.
Right,
and
right.
And so I went to the original screenwriter director and said, this is what I would propose to do. And I want to angle it more toward the community involvement. And because I think that it's the community, it's the village that are going to save our children. And we said it in Chicago, where children right now feel like they're under siege because of all the gun violence.
Yes.
And so the idea that if Akilah came out of a place where she's afraid, where she dislikes, but that there are unsung heroes in that neighborhood who are along her journey that support her. And it's going to take those type of people to help our children fulfill their dreams.
One thing that I was struck when I was watching the movie was, and I thought this myself, like just watching like Asian American, you know, entertainment stars come up is like a victory for one person in the community is a victory for the entire community. And I think they say that in the movie also.
Yes, yes. That's true. I think that we ignore, we believe when you look at the news and you look at some of the media representations of community, oftentimes it's sort of malign, you know, the worst parts of the community. Mm-hmm. But I feel that there's still those people in the community who are there to be teachers, who are there by example to sort of lead our children in a more productive way. I think that they're often ignored. And what I wanted to do is to set Akilah right in the heart of a neighborhood and how that neighborhood is changed by this girl's dream, because then they start to sort of activate their own dreams.
Right. And it's it's with all things. You need support from the people around you in order to rise up. It's not like you're pulling yourself up by your own bootstraps, which is that thing that we're all taught. But that's not necessarily true.
Yes, that's exactly true. And I think that what's really wonderful about the play is that we have these kids in it who are Latino, who are Asian, who are white, who are Black, who really also support each other because they're all sort of wanting this dream of being first place in the spelling bee. However, they also along the way start to support each other in each other's journey.
And I didn't make this correlation until you just said it, that the main kids that we hear the most from in the film are the Asian kid, the Latino kid, and Akilah. And so was that like a conscious choice on the part of the director of the film and on you of seeing the minority experience and these voices coming into what is traditionally a very white art form?
Yes, yes. I can't speak for Doug, but I would assume so, that what's interesting, you rarely see children of color who are Black or in the spelling bee, but that's changing, that's evolving. You do see quite a few Asian children in the spelling bees. But there's this Latino kid also in the play, in the movie. So I think there is a sense of, you know, the play looks like America. That there are people, that's the fabric of America of all colors that are represented in it.
How do you make a spelling bee exciting on stage? I mean, I never saw the Putnam County Spelling Bee, but they had music. And so I feel like that would eliminate some of the issues. And so is there music in this play too? Or how do you draw out the tension?
Oh, it's a challenge. There is music, but I think the characters are very, very idiosyncratic. So some of it is very humorous. Some of it, though, you're rooting for Akilah. So by the time we get to the National Bee, you actually in the audience can hear a pin drop, because I think that people are really, some of the comments we got were, the people felt like they were really in the spelling bee and right there in the audience, and they're rooting for her. And they are also, there are people that are spelling along with her, you know, which is interesting. Like it attracts these people who are really great spellers, because a lot of the words I couldn't spell. And there are actually people that are spelling loudly along with her in the spelling bee. So I think that they're, again, but it's, you know, I think that you try to draw very multi-layered characters that the audience wants to travel with. So when she's spelling, they're quiet. They're encouraging her on. And you do create tension because people are not sure who's going to win. And many of the kids play different characters. Akilah doesn't. She plays the same character all the time. But the rest of the kids in the play play multi-characters in different spelling bees. So they have their little quirks and stuff. But boy, during the spelling bees, you actually cannot hear people even moving a program. It's amazing.
Wow, like you don't usually see people. I mean, it's theater, so yes. so you know they're going to be really focused on words, but like not necessarily on spelling of these really complicated things.
It is really amazing, and people are just riveted. And I don't know if they're thinking she's going to make a mistake. I mean, people always ask, is there a cheat card somewhere? Is she? And I'm thinking, no, that girl has memorized six-syllable words. I mean, she's she's amazing at how she does it every single night and stay accurate. It's quite amazing. So I think there's this part of people wanting to see if it's going to be a wreck in front of them where she misses a word. And then I think, but mostly I believe people are rooting for her success. And they're not sure what's going to happen.
Yeah. So can you spell like prophylactic and recess and these really complicated words?
Yeah, no, I couldn't. I mean, and then I went on the actual Spelling Bee website and got some words mm-hmm. that were missed from the last years. And some of those words, I mean, they're just out there. You would not know these words. And then our dramaturg had to get sort of pronunciations for all of them so that mm-hmm. the pronouncers were saying it the same way that the spelling participants were saying it. So it was quite the process.
Yeah. Well, if we as writers don't know what these words mean, then, you know, good luck to these kids. Oh, my God.
Exactly. But they are really quite wonderful, these kids. And, you know, and it's wonderful to watch how their minds can absorb things so quickly. Mm-hmm. And I mean, if you ask any of the cast, they would say they got new pages so much during this process, and they would still have to be able to make those adjustments. And those kids were wonderful with that.
Were there any changes in between the children's theater version and Arena?
Amazingly so. Yeah, I made a lot of changes between. I think when you have your first production, you learn some things, but you run out of time to mm-hmm. sort of fix things, or you when you come back at it with some time in between, you kind of know the characters better. There are things that you wanted to get in. Now you can work on those. So we changed. I don't think maybe five pages went untouched. Everything got, you know, a little adjustment.
Was it the same cast as well?
Except for two people. Wow. We brought everybody from Minnesota. Except two cast members were recast in D.C. only because the two in Minnesota could not come to D.C.
Okay, wow. One thing that I was really curious about when I was watching the movie was because I'm Asian. So the portrayal of like the really strict tiger parenting. I mean, yes. was there and did you take away some of that stereotypical veneer, and like how did you treat it?
Well, the original writer. Director was very involved in our process as well. And one of the things he said that, you know, he got criticized quite a bit for that portrayal, though, you know, for some people that was thought of as accurate for mm-hmm. that particular character. What I did is give a little more backstory to the father so that we realize what he went through to become sort of so invested in his son being a winner and not being, quote, a loser. So I gave him a little bit more of a backstory that the film wasn't able to do. And also there were moments where you of levity with him as well. So, you know, I tried to just layer it better so right. that it wasn't just so, you know, black and white, if you will.
It's Playwright 101. You humanize the characters.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And the man we have playing him in D.C. is just wonderful. And there's moments that he's, you know, he scares you. And then other moments that you can just see sort of the pain behind why he's pushing his son and yeah. why he doesn't want his son to have the journey that he had in life.
Right. It's like there seems to be a growing focus on these backstories of these immigrant parents. And so it's right. it's just great to like see that the reason for this kind of parenting style is rooted in a very real pain.
Right. Very real pain. And wanting your child to always do better than you did. Mm-hmm. And I think that goes across color, class, race, that parents typically get very invested in their child exceeding what they were able to accomplish. And sometimes our sort of ways of going about that are not very productive or very successful or very kind, you know, because you can get so much focused on the goal and forget the person underneath there, and that your child wants to feel like you will accept him or her whether they get an A or not.
I saw your Pullman Porter Blues at the Goodman Theater when I was visiting Chicago.
Oh.
Yeah, and that set was beautiful, and you know, integration of the blues music with this really very real history and very defined characters. It was just a really lovely evening.
Thank you.
I was wondering, because you're talking about parents, and I noticed like that play was also about these generational differences and of, you know, rising up in the next generation. And I think that's something that you tackled with, was it Jar of the Floor?
Jar of the Floor, Pullman Porter Blues, probably with a lot of my work, actually. I hadn't put that together because I'm very interested in the foundations of family. How are they built? Are they built to withstand what kind of trauma, mm-hmm. what kind of storms? So I'm always interested in that. So, yeah, I probably explored that quite a bit in work because I think that I was blessed to know both sets of my great-grandparents.
Oh, wow.
And, yeah, my great-grandfather died at 99. He said he didn't want to see 100, and he died. He died right before he turned 100. Yeah, he said he wasn't interested. So, my great-grandmothers were 96 and 97 when they died. So that's quite a blessing for a writer because they were always telling stories. There was, you know, my great-grandparents, their entertainment when we would go to Mississippi to be with them was we would sit around and my great-grandfather would tell stories. Mm-hmm. And that really informed me how people could use words, could use stories to entertain. They weren't using music or TV or anything. It was just a good story.
What was the most memorable story that they told you?
Well, you know, one time we went to a church and a man, now I was rather young, and a man walked on all fours. And so I had never seen anybody who walked like this man did with his sort of rear end up in the air. And so I asked my great grandmother and she told me, don't look over there. That man has a tail. Okay, I was like, okay, really? And so she says, yeah, he was mean to a dog. His mother was mean to a dog while she was carrying him. And he came out walking like a dog, and he's got a tail. Well, you don't tell a kid like me something like that, because I'm so impressionable, and I have such an imagination. So every time I go to church, I'm looking at that man's butt and waiting on the tail to come out, right? So, and they would tell you these stories.
Yes.
That I believe they believed them, or they were so deadpan with them. But for me, I mean, I stayed up at night thinking, how does a man hide his tail in his suit? You know, what the man literally walked on all fours. I'd never seen anything like that. And that was their explanation because the mom kicked the dog. And, you know, so, but that's one that I sort of remember. But I think more than anything, I remember their use of language, that there mm-hmm. was some, though the language was very basic, but in the vernacular of it, it was something very poetic about it, how they would twist a turn, how lines had rhythm, how sayings had rhythm. And I just love that. You know, and I try to use that in my work.
It's so funny you're talking about these horrible explanations for, like, probably something that was pretty relatively easy to explain. Because I remember when I was growing up, my mom would tell me that she'd cut up a pineapple, and she'd tell me it was a little girl who was bad, and then she got turned into a pineapple, and that's why she's so ugly.
I know, people buy it. You're like, oh, I better not get better. I'm gonna be a pineapple.
Or I shouldn't kick a dog, or else I'm gonna walk on all fours.
Yeah, I mean, they were great at things like that, but because it's so visual, it makes it more vivid in some ways. Just in saying that, and so what playwrights aspire is to have words paint pictures for their audiences and have a sense of rhythm that the ear is engaged. And so I think I learned that at my great grandparents' knees.
And to create language that sticks with the audience so they remember that visual thing that you painted.
Yes.
So what else are you working on right now?
I'm doing a commission for Arena Stage, and it's a small musical. Can't say much more about it yet. I'm doing another project that's similar, maybe another small musical. So those two things right now. The other thing, I'm sort of revising a play called Basket Cases, and it's about basketball moms and who show up with their daughters at a tryout. And they end up trying each other, basically, because the world of sports, competitive youth sports, is a very tricky situation and very dramatic. And mothers, we've sort of upped the ante now about kids getting those scholarships, getting into college. And we put so much emphasis on that now, like in third grade, kids are having, you know, mental problems and breakdowns because of the pressure with sports. And, you know, they're playing all year round, so there's more stress injuries. And, you know, there's this whole divide about getting participation trophies or trophies that you earn because you are number one. So I'm working on that project as well.
And who is it for?
It was commissioned by Seattle Rep, and it just needs some more work. And we've done one workshop of it, and so I'm really working on it. But it's going to be a great piece for women roles because it's all the mothers. Mm-hmm. And I think there's four mothers who show up at tryouts, and one girl plays all of the parts. She plays all the daughters.
Oh, will she have to, like, actually dunk a ball?
She will have to be able to use her body. When we did the workshop, we actually had some basketball trainers come in and work with the cast, and it was wonderful.
Wow. Well, you always hear about basketball wives, and you hear about their children and the passing on of this legacy. So
this is more about this idea of how do you parent. Mm-hmm. How do you push your child? And when does encouragement lead to pushing? And when is it because of your unfulfilled dream that you now are trying to put on your child? So, you know, we have stage moms, but the sports moms can be very fierce and can also, I mean, I've been in gyms where people start fights. You know, their daughter, somebody saying something about the way their daughter is playing, and people have actually, you know, wanting to go to blows. I mean, it brings out the best behavior, but some of the most reprehensible behavior you've ever seen.
So do your kids play basketball? Is that why you were in this environment?
Yeah, one of them does.
So would you consider yourself a basketball mom as well?
I would imagine. I mean, I wrote most of Pullman Porter in the gyms while she was training or in tournaments. Yeah.
So is it her and a little bit of you, or is it like kind of usual mishmash of?
I would say the mishmash, just observing and reading and just you do this for years. When your child is an athlete, you're mm-hmm. years in gyms or whatever, or on fields with them before they learn how to drive. You're the one that's going to the training. And now it's not just they play with their school. Now the kids have to be trained and have trainers. And it's I just never seen anything like it. So it's like it really is a foreign world. And when you're on the outside of it, but your child is trying to participate in the inside of it, you get a real education.
Like in competitiveness and in...
Competitiveness yeah. and the fierceness of... You can be left out in fourth grade by not being trained. It's just ridiculous. I mean, when you look at it like that, it's rather ridiculous. And it's rather... I don't know if it's healthy what we're doing to the kids.
Is your daughter going to, how old is she? Is she going into this professionally, you think?
I don't think professionally. She does play at the college level, but that was a long journey.
And yeah. Hopefully she comes out of the other side intact.
Yes. And my other daughter plays rugby. So, yeah.
No artists in the family?
Oh, no. I don't think they think it's too much of a struggle.
Mm.
It's very interesting. Neither one. They enjoy the arts, but they would not think about going into it.
Okay. Well, it's a struggle of a different type, I think.
Yeah. It is. But I think that it's one thing when you watch your parent be an artist and see that the ups and downs of it. So some kids decide, well, I love it enough that I'll take that risk and I'll do better than my parent. Then other kids are like, not for me, you know? So that they're more than not for me people.
Play sports instead. It's another kind of pain.
Yeah. And I think that they'll probably be in business.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
You did very well.
Thank you. I think so. As a single parent, I think I did. They're good girls.
That was everything I wanted to ask you. So thank you for sitting down. And
so too bad you haven't seen it, though, because it does depart from the movie.
It's in D.C., so whenever I'm 2 weeks away from going back home to California, which is where I'm from, and so it's very difficult to get out of town right now.
Okay. Yeah. Well, it's doing quite well with the audiences down there.
Good. Well, anything that teaches its audiences how to spell properly, I support.
You're paying, huh?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, this is great. Thank you for getting on the phone with me. I really appreciate it.
No problem, Deep. And happy holidays to you.
Happy holidays to you, too.
And we're back. We just realized that we forgot to cross our T's here. The stories that Susie wrote for our online about theater on TV, and one is just specifically about this latest trend.
Yeah, there's two stories. One is about the trend of live musical broadcasts on national television. So you have The Wiz Live and Grease Live is coming up January 31st on Fox, and then the past one, Sound of Music and Peter Pan. And then I did a separate article, which we sort of addressed in our earlier conversation, about nonprofit theater being broadcast on TV. PBS has a lot of series like Great Performances, Live from Lincoln Center, but they also have things like Theater Close-Up, which broadcasts off-Broadway productions in the Tri-State area. And there's also a new program called On Stage in the USA. On Stage in America.
Right.
My bad. That broadcast regional nonprofits to national audiences. It just did its pilot, which was Honky at San Diego Rep. And they're trying to get picked up to series with a partnership with PBS. And then there's other things like National Theatre Live, which is a nonprofit in the UK, but has also worked with things like the Stratford Festival in Toronto and Roundabout in New York. And so, there's kind of two separate and related trends that there's stories online. I think I don't remember the headlines, but they're online and they're interesting.
You can look for them. I think if you search with TV as in the
yeah
in the search line, you'll be able to find them. So let's go to recommendations. Dee, what do you have for recommendations this week?
Sure. I have something that you guys can read.
It's and we're going to be posting it to our Facebook today because it was one of those times where someone wrote something that I had always thought, but I never actually wrote, and I kind of wish I did. It's called In Defense of Benny from Rent by Courtney Enlow on Pagiba.com, P-A-G-I-B-A. It's about the character of Benny from Rent, who is the yuppie character who is played by Taye Diggs in the original.
He's always demanding the rent, right?
Demanding the rent.
He's the landlord. He's the bad guy.
Yeah.
Apparently, he's the quote unquote bad guy from Rent, you know, trying to make all these artists who don't want to pay rent on their spaces.
Yeah.
And then this article is defending that character because it's life. You need to pay your rent, and he's letting you guys stay for free. So why are you turning him into the bad guy? He also paid for Angel's funeral,
right,
even though Angel killed his dog.
Yeah, no, I think I always had a soft spot for Benny.
Yeah. Benny's a good guy. Yeah. Yes.
He gets demonized for no reason.
I don't understand that musical, actually, because while I do love the music, I always thought that these artists were kind of entitled because they wanted to be loved and to be supported just for being artists, which is really selfish because that's not the point of art making, especially if you're making it for an audience. And so you just have to pay your bills.
I'm not a big Rent fan, but it's a very romantic idea. It's from La Boheme.
Yeah.
This idea that you sacrifice self for your art. A lot of those people are, it's part of a movement of squatters from the 90s, 80s and 90s
mm-hmm.
in New York. I mean, some of them really sort of marginalized people, but I know that almost all of them have AIDS in the musical. But yeah, I mean, I can't defend that. I mean, a lot of people's reaction to the musical is like, just pay the damn rent. Like, what's the problem?
Or like, get money from your parents who are calling you all the time, and they obviously have money to support you. That's why they're calling
you.
But
I mean, you know, the thing is, Larson was definitely part of that scene. Like, people scrapping it together, just barely making ends meet.
I don't think they were making ends meet. They weren't paying their rent.
Yeah.
Right.
Or their bills. They turned off the heat, too.
But that fire was pretty sweet.
I mean, that romantic idea is appealing. But yeah, I get what you're saying.
That's how I knew I was an old person, when I identified more with Benny than with the artist with AIDS. I'm sorry, guys.
All right, Susie, what do you have?
I went to the wonderful city of Chicago for Thanksgiving week, which is one of my favorite places in the country to visit. And I got to see my first full Q Brothers productions. If you haven't heard of the Q Brothers, you should check them out.
Wait, you've never seen a full production?
I've never seen a full production.
My God. Yeah.
I know, right?
What are the Q Brothers?
The Q Brothers are two brothers from Chicago, JQ and GQ, and they do, I think their real names are Gregory and Jeffrey. Sorry, guys, outed. But they go by JQ and GQ, and they do like hip hop, like spoken word adaptations of mostly Shakespeare plays. Their first play was The Bombardy of Errors, which premiered in New York in about the late 90s.
It was a huge hit.
Huge hit. I mean, their latest big hit is Othello the Remix, which was commissioned by The Globe in England for their like national Shakespeare festival, where they had a Shakespeare play in every single language, and American hip hop was considered a separate language from English. And so they did Othello, which was the first tragedy they'd ever done. Their stuff is kind of funny. And so, but it's, I've seen parts of Othello the Remix. I saw it at NAMMT when they did it there. But I've interviewed them a few times. I've met them several times, but I've never actually seen a full production. And right
now,
you
saw their Christmas Carol.
I saw the Q Brothers Christmas Carol at Chicago Shakespeare, which is different for them because it's not Shakespeare. But it's at Chicago Shakespeare. And it's really, you know, it's really amusing. It's, you know, it's not going to change your life, but it's a really fun night in the theater. It's silly. There's a good Trump joke at the beginning, you know.
Okay. I gotta have one of those right now.
You know, well, you got Scrooge and Trump, so you gotta.
That's perfect.
You gotta make the joke.
Right.
It's really good. It's usually performed. All their shows are performed by an ensemble of four.
So it's just four. Okay.
Just four, and they wrote it with the two guys who perform with them, whose names I don't remember, but it was the same two guys who did Othello with them at NAMMT.
Oh, Pastel and I forget.
They're great, and so. It's the Q Brothers Christmas Carol. It's running through January 3rd, I think, at Chicago Shakespeare. And if you're not in Chicago, I mean, they've got YouTube videos and stuff you can check out online if they're like spoken word and hip hop. They've been doing this since the 90s. I mean, they're not like piggybacking.
I mean, I would say that, yeah, their Othello remix, what I just happened to catch when I was in town some years ago, was great. And it really is a tragedy. They really did go all the way with the tragedy, which was And, you know, they have this one white guy with a wig playing Desdemona and, like, not doing very convincing drag, but somehow by the end of the show is completely moved and you know, they know what they're doing. They're great theater artists, basically, as well as good hip-hoppers.
Yeah, so check out – they've got a show at Chicago Shakes. And Othello the Remix is coming back at Chicago Shakes later this season. So if you're around Chicago, make sure to keep your eye on that.
Well, briefly, I am going to recommend a podcast, which I don't think we've talked about on our podcast yet. I mentioned it in the column recently. Mac Rogers, who is a big star of our sci-fi issue, playwright based here in New York, wrote this podcast called The Message, which I knew.
He wrote that podcast?
Yeah, he wrote that.
Oh my gosh, they keep advertising it on.
Yeah, and I have to say, that ad really turned me off because it keeps interrupting my other Slate podcast.
Me too.
And I wasn't a fan of the ad, and then I actually heard from somebody that he wrote it. It's like, okay, I'm going to listen to it, and it's actually really great.
It's creepy girl narrate it?
She narrates the whole thing, but she's not as she turns out to be fairly creepy, actually. No spoilers. But it's like a lot of his plays. He's a great sort of striptease artist of exposition. Like, what? Wait, who? What? You know, so a lot of twists in it, a lot of kind of mind-blowing twists. And it is basically, unapologetically, very much a sci-fi piece about alien communications. But it's really smartly done, and it really uses the podcast / old radio form. Like, it's a good convergence. It uses tropes from Serial, like, you know, where she reaches out to people and she, oh, I have a new source that we haven't considered yet. So it really feels like, as Mac called it, Serial with aliens. So,
and is it like a murder mystery? Like, what, Twilight Zone thing? What is it?
It is a, it's, they've sort of overbuilt it as like War of the Worlds, but it's not like War of the Worlds so much. It's a fake podcast called Cybercast or Cyphercast, in which this young woman has been invited into this elite research unit where they're researching this message, this audio message that was sent 70 years ago, apparently by aliens, and every crew that's worked on it has had some problems happen to them. So they're not sure what that's all about. That's the basic.
Is it a true story?
Oh, God, no. Like, not even remotely. But
it's all fictionalized?
Yeah, it's all fictionalized.
These Slate ads make it seem like it's true.
It's a fictional story.
Okay.
It's totally fictional. But it's played like reality, I guess, like War of the Worlds. You would not be confused listening to it like this is real. But it uses the tropes of those journalism. And it actually kind of gets under your skin because it sounds sort of real. It sounds sort of plausible. And actually, interestingly, it's partly funded by GE. And it talks about some technology that GE is funding, which is a weird sort of, I don't know if Mac was required or they just made, look, we have this technology.
Was this Mac's idea or did they ask him to write it?
They asked him. And what's interesting, there's a piece on Slate, if you really want to go deep into this, where Mac talks about how he was about to do the Honeycomb trilogy, the rep at Jim at Judson. And he was like the busiest time of his life, and he gets this offer to do what he called Serial with Aliens. And he goes, I can't turn this down. So it was like the busiest fall any playwright has ever had, writing this podcast and staging his
Is
his
writing for
plays.
Podcasts a lucrative career?
I don't know if it's lucrative. I haven't asked him about that.
It's like
sure
playwrights go write for TV. Maybe they write for podcasts.
I would imagine it might be better paid than being a playwright, but who knows?
Radio
who knows?
Plays are a big deal. I mean, Naked Angels does them.
Yeah. And then, you know, it's interesting. They didn't reveal the credits until the very last episode. So I was trying to guess who the actors were, and Robert Stanton plays one of the leads. He's a New York theater actor. There are a couple other ones. Gideon Glick is in it.
Oh, wow.
But you might not recognize his voice when you hear it. So
I started listening to that podcast, the You Must Remember This. So good.
Isn't that good?
Yes. I'm going to second recommend that. Rob's recommended it before, but check out You Must Remember This.
Are you doing the MGM stories now?
No, I'm still in the Manson.
Oh, my God. That Manson
so
thing
good.
Is amazing.
It's creepy, though.
I will say the MGM stories he's doing this season, just to digress on that, kind of make Hollywood seem like, of the threes and fours, seem like the most debauched, depressing, awful place to ever be in the world. Like, just
worse than when Charles Manson
was
like.
Yeah, well, this what's interesting is like, yeah. I mean, similarly, like maybe not as bad as that. Anyway, let's close with another recommendation for other podcasts. But please go to iTunes and rate our podcast. Tell people how much you like it. Tell people about it. It helps other people find it. That does it for today.
See you next time.
Yeah.